Hello, everyone. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 133 of Weed All About It, or what I'm calling Soil Quality Steals the Spotlight, about a presentation soil scientist Shannon Capolazzi gave during the Lynn Dryland Research Farm Field Day about the Soil Health Institute, specifically the undertaking called the North American Project to evaluate soil health measurements. It intends to analyze samples from mostly U.S. sites at 120 different locations using a new definition for what's important in soil health and how farmers might change their practices to get more out of their soil with fewer inputs. Soil science, specifically soil quality, has taken center stage recently. WSU has multiple new soil scientists coming on board across the state in addition to current staff. With funding from the legislature, WSU has also launched a soil health initiative. All the attention makes sense. We know more about the birds in the sky above us than the microorganisms under our feet. There was a strict set of requirements for land to be considered for inclusion in the Institute's soil testing project. They included having the same management practice for 10 years, good records and replicated trials, with one soil health management practice different between treatments on the same piece of ground. Turns out the principal scientist at the Lynn Dryland Research Station, Bill Schillinger, has been working with Ritzville farmer Ron Giray for 23 years, doing all of the above. Listen to a fascinating interview I did with Schillinger in episodes 77 and 78 entitled The Dryland Doctor, available at the Washington Grain Commission website, wagrains.org. Click on summaries and navigate back into time. The Soil Health Institute is a relatively new nonprofit, only established in 2015. It was the brainchild of researchers working on different aspects of soil biology who believed that a public-private partnership to dig into soil just made sense. Capolazzi said the emphasis is on rigorous science. To make a point of that, project scientists like her had to have their PhDs. I didn't get a chance to interview Capolazzi at Lynn, but when I called later, she told me there's six people working on the project across the U.S., with another individual devoted to measuring and managing data. Even with all the changes in technology that have occurred around me over the last decade, I haven't given much thought to how that technology might be extended to soil monitoring with the goal of bringing a rigorous statistical analysis to soil health. 15 or 20 years ago, in my other life as a reporter for the Capital Press, I did a story about a company called Decagon Devices, about one of their new products, a remote moisture meter. Turns out that Decagon merged with the German company and is now called the Meter Group. One of the Meter Group's products, it turns out, is called a Saturo, and it quantifies a soil's saturated hydraulic conductivity, a measure of how quickly water moves through it. Another device measures the respiration of the soil. There will be, in fact, 30 individual tests conducted on each sample. I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to sit down with Capolazzi. She's an excellent speaker, energetic and passionate about her chosen field. Even filtered through a speaker system with a bit of wind sound and chirping birds, her voice comes through clearly. Capolazzi's not a farm gal, but she's a rural gal, raised along with the livestock animals she showed in 4-H on 5 acres 20 miles outside of Portland. Her undergraduate degree was in animal sciences. A job buying organic fertilizer ingredients got her thinking about what she didn't know. She went back for her PhD at Oregon State University. Her thesis is about the intersection of fertility and microbiology. I recorded Capolazzi on June 13, 2019, as she presented to a group of farmers, WSU researchers and administrators, students, government officials, and others on the grass under the trees at the Lynn Research Station. This is an edited version of her talk. After explaining a bit about the larger project, Capolazzi asked her audience a couple of questions. One easy, the other less so.
How many of you here have heard of soil health? Everybody has. It is the greatest thing in the entire world, right? It is the new hot topic. It's what everybody's talking about. But how about this? Who can tell me what soil health is? I don't see any hands. Who can tell me what soil health is? Okay, I'll give you a definition. If there's nothing else we come away from today, I want everybody to know what soil health is and what soil health is about. Okay? So soil health is the continued capacity of the soil to function. I want you to key in on that word. I'm going to talk a lot about it. It's the function. Continued capacity of the soil to function as a vital living ecosystem within the land use boundaries and ecosystems that the soil is in. So there's two main things that I want you to key in on here. One is that capacity to function, and the other is this vital living ecosystem. All right, so who can tell me something that soil does? What is a function of soil? Holds up trees, right? Yeah, you like that one right now, don't you? It's a growing medium for plants, right? It is what we grow most of our plants in. What more specifically allows us to grow plants in the soil? Moisture retention, absolutely. Not only does it hold that moisture, but it allows the moisture to be infiltrated into the system. It filters the water, it holds it, and it delivers it to those plants, right? Helps to deliver it to those plants. What else? We have, it grows plants, and it holds, stores, and delivers water. Stores, holds, and delivers nutrients. There's one other thing I would add to that, and that is that it cycles nutrients. The living organisms in the soil are what are responsible for taking organic matter and making those nutrients available to the plants. Okay? Uh-oh, we've got a little wind here. Okay, so what else does the soil do?
Habitat.
Habitat, absolutely. Why do we care if soil is a habitat? Well, what do you need in a habitat? You need food, right? Most organisms in the soil are heterotrophic. That means they need carbon for their food and for their energy. Okay, so they need food. What else?
Water.
Water, right? They need water, they need air, they need food. And what's that final part of habitat that we might think of?
Shelter.
Shelter is the other thing that we need. We build beautiful structures to give us shelter from the elements. The microbes in the soil also need that shelter, right? Do you know how they build that shelter or what that shelter is? It's things called soil aggregates. That is their shelter. And part of the way that they do that is these microbes exude things out of their body. The same way that plants exude different chemicals, whether it's sugars or acids, they exude things out of their body. Well, these microbes also are exuding proteins, sugars, nucleic acids, enzymes, all of these things, and they use that to build up their habitat. And that is what they live in. That is what helps them trap food. That's what allows them to hold water. That is what provides the physical structure that they need in order to have that balance between air and water. Okay? So we care about the soil as a habitat because that is what the microbes need in order to perform their functions. And when we talk about all of these other functions of the soil, it's largely the microbes that are doing it, right? The microbes are producing the enzymes to cycle the nutrients to break down the organic matter into plant-available nutrients. The microbes are building these aggregates. They're gluing these soil particles together so that we can get some larger pore spaces, so that the water can infiltrate into the soil, so that the water can be stored in the soil and then delivered again back to the plants. Another reason we might care about habitat is because the organisms that are in there are working together. If we have just one single grain kind of system and nothing is glued together, these organisms don't have the community that they need. And each microbe has a different job. Just like every different kind of cell in your body has a different job, the different kinds of microbes in the soil are doing different jobs. And so we want them to all have the things that they need so that each of these functions can work together to build a soil. We talk about this soil as a continued capacity to function. Why do we care about that? As producers, I would say one of the biggest things you have to worry about is being able to crop to plant your crop the next year. You have to be economically sustainable in order for you to continue your job, in order for you to give your family the food, the water, the shelter that they need, right? So the reason that we are focused on how the soil functions is because if we can get a soil to do some of these functions for us, we can reduce our input costs. If we can reduce the amount of fertilizers that we're using or chemical pesticides because we have a better natural balance, then we can decrease our cost of our inputs, thereby increasing our profit. One of the biggest things, I think, in your area, one of the biggest things that is of concern is the ability to store and deliver water. If we can increase the soil's ability to hold water and infiltrate water first so that it is there in the first place and then hold that water and make more of that water available to plants, that's going to be better for your bottom line. Everything's going to come down to whether or not you have enough water to grow your crops when you're in a dry land system. And so what we are trying to do is enhance the practices that allow producers to have better water retention, higher nutrient cycling, a higher diversity, which allows for a broader functional diversity in the soil, so that we can, in the end, grow crops, right? So that's kind of that first part of that definition, the continued capacity of the soil to function. The next part is as a vital living ecosystem, right? So there is more... There are more organisms in the ground under our feet than everything that we can see above ground. All the elephants in the world, all the biomass, it dwarfs what's going on below the ground. And it's those organisms that are doing the work. We need to be able to feed that microbial community in order for them to perform the functions. And we feed that community largely with carbon. They need nitrogen, they need magnesium, calcium, sulfur, they need all of these other things too. But if they don't have carbon, they're kind of dead in the water. They're not going to be able to cycle all of these other nutrients. They're not going to be able to do their work. What are a couple of the things that we talk about for increasing organic matter? Did I hear somebody say no-till? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Reducing your tillage or using no-till practices can have a very beneficial impact. One of the things I like to think about with tillage is, okay, well, how is tilling the soil going to impact the biological community? If you were to imagine a tornado coming through your community once a year, two times a year, six times a year, what would happen? What would you do after that tornado came through each time? You might leave. They just might die. They might not really be all that active. They might not do much. They might only have energy to try to rebuild their structures so that they can start to do their work again. If there's a tornado coming through my town six times a year, I might absolutely just leave. I might also not get any of my other work done because I don't have time. I don't have the energy. I don't have the physical resources. I don't have the building blocks necessary because that stuff was just torn apart. So when we're going through a tillage, we are disrupting their habitat. All of the structures that they are working on building and putting together, those are taken apart when we till. And those aggregates that they have been gluing together and making these large pore spaces, they get disrupted. So that's one of them. And in this area, that's probably the one that producers have taken up the most. What else is often talked about for soil health management practices? Another thing that we can do is increase the diversity. When we increase the number of crops or even increase by adding animals into the rotation, we can disrupt certain cycles that are going on in the soil. And when we have more above ground diversity, we tend to see more below ground diversity. And that below ground diversity is going to allow for more functional diversity in the soil, more of those chemical reactions that we rely on going on underground. And then the final thing is adding organic matter itself, right? The whole goal is to increase soil carbon so that the microbes have food available for them to do their functions. And so one of the things we can do is we can just straight feed them. We can put compost or manures or biosolids or any other kind of organic matter onto the soil to give them that carbon, and that's going to increase that organic matter. And there are some really tangible impacts from that. When you have higher organic matter, you have higher available water holding capacity. And in dryland systems, we know higher available water holding capacity is going to increase your crop's ability to be successful. The last thing I want to talk about here on this definition is the within land use and ecosystem boundaries. The reason that that's part of the definition is because soils are really variable. Soils in Idaho are different than soils in New York. And so there's been a lot of work that's been done at Cornell. They have a comprehensive assessment of soil health that does a lot to start giving you an idea of what's going on with the biological community of the soil. They separate things into three major textural categories: coarse, medium, and fine. Well, a coarse textured soil in Idaho is going to be different than a coarse textured soil in New York. But we have a system developed by the NRCS back in the 60s that's somewhat different in each state. But generally, what they're trying to do is take into account these inherent qualities of the soil. So texture is not something you're going to change in your lifetime. The depth to bedrock is not something you're going to change. Maybe a little bit with erosion. But for the most part, the depth to a water table or bedrock is not something you're going to change. The number of frost-free days. Again, maybe over long terms that has changed, and we have seen more frost-free days in this area. But for the most part, these are inherent characteristics of the area. The place develops the soil. So when there are these climactic and parent material and things that impact the soil's inherent capability, we want to compare those to other soils that have similar type features. So it's not just texture, but it's also other restrictive features in growing that we want to compare to. The system that the NRCS has put together is called Land Capability Class. A soil that's in a Land Capability Class 1 has no restrictive features. There's not very many frost days. There's a texture that has enough water holding capacity, enough clay to store nutrients and store carbon. And, you know, there's no problems with depth to bedrock or tillage pans. It is in a land capability class 1. And then as you increase the challenges, that number goes down. And so if you have a really challenging system, we want to compare that to other people who are in a really challenging system and see how your soil health looks in that comparison. And so when I talk about making these assessments useful to producers, what I want to talk about is economics. Because it's not going to be very useful to give you a lot of genomic information or information on the phospholipid fatty acid markers that tell you what group of bacteria is in which area of your field, unless it comes down to and revolves around how it's going to impact your bottom line and how your management practices are changing that, right? So we want to be able to give you a interpretation of the test that we are doing that is meaningful. And the way I think that might be useful is by grouping these different assessments by function. We have about 30, depends on how you want to call it, but about 30 different metrics that we are measuring through this really comprehensive program. And when I say 30, the entire genomics project is considered one. The entire PLFAs is one. All of the enzymes is considered one. We've got a lot of different metrics that we are measuring in this test. But what we want to know is, what are the tests that we need in order for you to be able to make a decision about how well your soil is cycling nutrients? In order for something to be useful, if you can take a soil test on your field that you have been doing the same way for the last 30 years, and for the last 5 years, you've tried doing no-till over here, and we do a soil test of those two things, we want to be able to tell you if there is a difference in those soils, right? And so the traditional way that we've been doing this is saying, oh, yeah, there is more organic matter, there is higher aggregate stability, there is a difference in pH. But what does that actually mean as far as the function in the soil? So what we want to do is group it by, okay, is my soil cycling nutrients more quickly? Are there more nutrients available to my plants because of this practice? And if there are more nutrients available because of these practices, does that mean that I can reduce my fertilization rate? If there is more diversity in the soil, and does that mean that I will be able to decrease a pesticide use of some sort or a fungicide use because the balance of the organisms in the soil might be doing some of that work of fighting the organisms that we don't want? If I increase my organic matter, am I truly changing that available water holding capacity and the rate of water infiltration? Am I getting more water into my soil? Is it moving faster through the soil? Is it holding more? Is it delivering more to the plants? So we're taking groups of metrics that we measure in this study and looking at how those can be grouped together based on function to assess whether or not your management practices are enhancing the capability of the soil to function. And then once we do that, we're grouping them by like soils. So instead of comparing, say, you know, Florida and the Palouse, we want to group soils that are similar, that have similar inherent capabilities. One thing that I want to point out here is that we have, in this project, have a huge strength in the number of wheat trials that we sampled in this project. There's about 120 sites altogether, and about 60 of those have some kind of wheat system in them, which is more than any other crop in the entire project. In the Pacific Northwest, there are 8 of our different sites that have wheat in them, plus 2 in California, 9 in the Canadian Prairies, 13 in the Great Plains. We have some in Mexico, in the Southeast, in the Midwest, and in the Northeast. All of our major regions have some kind of wheat system. Now, some of them are more in a cover crop kind of system where they're using winter wheat as a winter cover crop. But a lot of them are dry land wheat in the Northwest. For a long time, people have recommended taking soil tests because that way you can calculate what your plants need as far as nutrients. And those chemical soil tests have really helped producers increase productivity. And so for a lot of reasons, they are really beneficial for a producer. And those who take regular soil tests, know what nutrients they need to add, can do that. But that idea is largely based on traditional soil chemistry. And the more we get into understanding about the soil, the more we understand the impact that the biology has, the impact that the biology plays in cycling these nutrients, making them available, providing a structure for the plants to grow in. And so this new framework for taking soil health measurements is largely focused on the impact of the organisms and how they are enhancing or decreasing your soil's ability to function. We want that soil to function so that you don't have to do as many functions. There are people who have had a lot of success with these different management practices who have been able to decrease their chemical inputs, their fertilizer inputs, start later in the season when they need their irrigation. Not relevant for you guys here, but there are ways to decrease your inputs, have the soil do more work, and that's what we're trying to get at. So we want to be able to make this soil health testing something that is useful to you so that you can use it to assess different management practices specific to your growing conditions and find ways that are going to allow you to be more productive with less inputs. I know that it is getting close to lunch, and so I want to just leave you with one last thing here. And that, again, is the definition. Because when I first started, there was nobody out here who could give me the definition. I want you to think about this. It is the capacity of the soil to function as a vital living ecosystem. The capacity of the soil to function as a vital living ecosystem. That is what we are trying to do in order to enhance our agronomic productivity, environmental health, and economic systems throughout our agricultural production systems.
I'm excited about the Soil Health Institute effort. They are riding the crest of a wave of interest because, as Capolazzi said, soil health is the new hot topic. I hope they're successful in their effort to promote the capacity of the soil to function as a vital living ecosystem. It just makes sense. What can't be lost in the process toward the goal, however, is the role of farmers who must continue to feed more than 7 billion people on the planet and make a profit. On that last point, I think Capellazzi went out of her way to frame the Institute's efforts as seeking solutions that are economically feasible. Okay, folks, it's time again to take the initiative. At field days this summer, I've run into two types of individuals, those who have listened to the podcast and those who haven't. The haven'ts remain in the majority. Although I'm always talking about how easy it is to subscribe to Weed All About It on iPhones, many individuals my age haven't mastered the idea of podcasts, let alone how to access them, no matter how easy it is. I say again, listeners, you are my marketers. When people tell you they haven't listened to the podcast or that they've heard a few, ask for your friends' or acquaintances' phones. Open the Purple Podcast app on the iPhone. If it's been deleted, as I have found many have, go to the App Store and reinstall. Click on the magnifying glass called the Finder and begin typing the words, "Weed All About It." A link to the podcast usually comes up after the first two words. Subscribe! For those without iPhones, Stitcher, spelled S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R, is a great podcast app that is easy to download. To those farmers I met who are listening to the podcast, thank you! But as farmers, you understand the idea of spreading your costs over more acres. Because I need to spread my Weed All About It efforts over more listeners. You are yet part of a relatively small fraternity of listeners. Step out of your comfort zone, ask for that phone, and help grow this acorn of a podcast into the mighty oak it yearns to be. Then join me here again next week for another episode of Weed All About It!
We're all children of a special treat, a miracle of nature that we just call wheat. A crop that's in the Bible, a crop that's in our bread, a crop that's filled our bellies and held us in good stead. Through a history of starvation and times of want and woe, wheat has been our savior, our grub, our gruel, our dough. There's always lots of problems when we have enough to eat, but there's only one dilemma when it's not enough wheat. We feed you.